Coming up next is KORC News, Music, and Civics on KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. We stream worldwide at korcfm.com. And if you'd like to make a year-end contribution to help support independent news, which is not an easy operation to carry out, korcfm.com/donate. Your support will help us grow and strengthen our effort in decades to come. KORC is in this for the long haul. We want to be the voice of this community for decades to come, and that takes listener support. If you'd like to be a part of that, korcfm.com/donate. We appreciate your tax-deductible support of independent radio in Corvallis.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Hello, KORC listeners. This is Wendy Byrne. I'm going to read a recent As I See It opinion piece from the Corvallis Gazette Times, 26 December. 2024. This was written and submitted by John Robinson. His byline states, Albany businessman John Robinson is a general contractor involved in residential remodeling and building activities. The As I See It is titled, Do Not Go Down This Same Rabbit Hole. There were two recent articles published, one titled, Corvallis Looks to Drum Up Millions for Facilities Project, December 19th, and Albany Residents Decry Solutions That Would Usher in More Affordable Housing, December 21st. I would like to provide a viewpoint of how these two issues are related. The Corvallis article basically details the quandary of how to fund a new City Hall complex with a price tag of $189 million. It lists three options for funding the project: new revenue sources, expanding existing revenue, and freeing up existing revenue. One important thing highlighted was identifying the revenue sources that do not require voter approval. This is important because it seems the city and the same council members recognize that many in the community are not supportive of more taxes and fees. Missing from the discussion is how much revenue the city of Corvallis has lost in handing out 30-year property tax exemptions for affordable housing. More on that later. The article in Albany details the December 11 City Council meeting where individuals like myself spoke opposed to both excise tax on construction and a 20-year tax exemption for new affordable housing projects. While city staff can estimate how much money they would steal with a construction excise tax, they are unable to put a dollar figure on the lost revenue from a 20-year property tax exemption. The city has no idea how that future revenue shortfall would be made up. As an Albany resident and business owner, this greatly concerns me, as I believe it should concern every Albany taxpayer. Now, here is the tie-in of those two issues. Corvallis previously enacted both a construction excise tax and a 30-year property tax exemption to incentivize affordable housing. But as I warned back in December of 2022, this scam is really creating subsidized housing and a future financial disaster. I estimated that a single project could cost the city $10 million to $15 million over 30 years in lost revenue. How ironic that Corvallis is now trying to figure out how to fund a new city hall. I question whether they even know how much revenue they have forfeited on projects with the 30-year property tax exemption. My warning to Albany was to not go down the same rabbit hole. The idea that Albany has to follow Corvallis's lead and enact every tax and policy is absurd. Some people live in Albany because they cannot afford to live in Corvallis. Enacting the same policies, taxes, and fees that increase the cost of housing in Albany is not beneficial to those coming to Albany in search of more affordable housing. We can disagree on the actual amount of lost revenue. The reality is there is no cap on the number of projects that the city will give a property tax exemption to. Portland does not have an actual cost of the revenue they have lost on their 10-year property tax exemption for affordable housing, but it estimates it is between $129 million to $135 million on just the current projects. Past history in Albany reveals a city council that mostly rubber stamps every proposal that city staff present. This needs to change. Why is it that city employees, who are not elected, are able to decide which issues are socially pressing and then formulate their solution to said problems, with the result always involving more taxpayer money? This grows government and the need for more people to manage said programs. I hope this is a wake-up call, because from what I see, the new affordability crisis is the cost of government. That was an As I See It opinion piece submitted to the Corvallis Gazette Times newspaper by Albany businessman John Robinson. John Robinson is a general contractor involved in residential remodeling building activities. This As I See It was published in the Corvallis Gazette Times on the 26th of December, 2024. I hope you listeners found it interesting to hear that opinion piece from John Robinson of Albany. I found it very interesting to read it myself, considering construction of housing and the development of businesses in and around Corvallis and Albany is a pretty hot topic these days. In fact, that piece from John Robinson was accompanied by a second As I See It in the paper on that same day, December 26th, by Corvallis resident Bjorn Beers, titled "Why I Really Resigned from the Corvallis Planning Commission." These two opinion pieces give us insight into the challenges our cities and our local developers are facing as we move forward into 2025 with the housing crisis on our minds. Corvallis and Albany are cities that experience a fairly high proportion of rent-burdened residents. Albany's John Robinson points out that granting long-term tax exemptions in Corvallis has led to decreased tax revenue for a city that is struggling to determine how to find revenue to pay for the projects that we want to build, such as a new police department facility and a new civic administration facility. I know we've been discussing that on Corvallis Civics Cafe over the last several episodes. He cautions Albany city leaders to learn from what he thinks are Corvallis's mistakes. In his piece, Bjorn Beers makes the claim that requiring developers to pay for systems development charges drives would-be developments away from Corvallis. He repeats a claim that I have heard from other builders, calling Corvallis, quote, notoriously anti-development, unquote. I would point out that granting exemptions to developers does not mean the need to cover the costs of infrastructure magically disappears. It just leaves the taxpayer holding the tab. You cannot develop housing or commercial property without roads and utilities leading to it, so who pays to build those items, and in the long run, who pays to maintain them? Corvallis and Albany are not alone in this quandary. With the property tax limitations created by Oregon's Measures 5 and Measure 50, every city in Oregon faces similar challenges about how to cover the costs of building and maintaining a city in this day and age. In the long run, what works for Albany might not work for Corvallis and vice versa. We would be wise to learn from one another as we seek our solutions, and it is helpful to share opinions and experiences with each other from city to city. The cities might have similar population sizes and be close on the map, but our tax bases are quite different, a fact that cannot be disregarded nor minimized when it comes to making decisions about how to move forward with incentivizing development of housing, of commercial property, and of city facilities. As we wind down 2024, I'd like to wish everyone a safe and festive New Year's Eve. Let's walk purposefully into 2025 and stay focused on local food, local fun, and local politics. Here at the Corvallis Civics Cafe, I will continue to discuss Corvallis politics. I'm looking forward to watching how the new members of our City Council settle into their seats, and I hope you join me. As always, if you have questions for me, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have questions for KORC's news, music, and civics, send us an email at news@korcfm.com.
Hi, KORC listeners. This is JC, and I had the recent fortune of being able to attend a musical event at Old World Deli. The band that was performing was Blue Egyptian. They're from Chico, California, which is in the northern Sacramento Valley. And in 2024, they did 138 shows. They traveled to 85 cities. They performed at 13 festivals. They traveled to 9 states, and they did 7 tours. They toured with Blackberry Smoke, Air Supply, Samantha Fish, Sum 41, Marcus King, and ZZ Top, among others. The band members in Blue Egyptian are four musicians: Don Jules, who does the lead guitar and vocals and writes many of their songs; Cam Fuller on bass; Neo Spectrum, who performs fiddle, synth, keyboards, and vocals; and Zach Graham, who performs drums and vocals. In 2024, they released their most recent album, Chantress of Amun, and I'm going to feature them by playing a song from that album. It's called Smith Rock. It's hard to categorize what genre Blue Egyptian is in, but I guess I could call them indie with lots of other influences. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about them after you hear Smith Rock. That was Blue Egyptian with their most recent release, Smith Rock, from their 2024 album, Chantress of Amun. They travel a lot to Oregon, and I had the recent fortune of being able to hear them at Old World Deli. I'm looking forward to talking with Jules, the lead guitarist, vocalist, and primary songwriter for Blue Egyptian in the near future. I'd also like to do a shout out to Old World Deli for featuring incredible music and inviting musicians from all over the West Coast and the country to come and perform at their venue. You can check out their schedule at oldworldcenter.com. If you have a moment, check out Blue Egyptian. They're spelled B-L-U with an umlaut and Egyptian, E-G-Y-P-T-I-A-N. We've downloaded all their songs from their latest album, Chantress of Amun, in the KORC library, and look forward to playing their music in the future. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
Jacqueline Romero from the Oregon Capital Chronicle reports, invasive murder hornets found in Washington have been eradicated, officials say. The hunt for invasive murder hornets is over in Washington and the rest of the U.S. after 3 years without confirmed detections, state and federal officials said on Wednesday. It's a rare day when humans actually get to win one against the insects, said Steven Spischiger, Washington State Department of Agriculture Pest Program Manager. The insects, more formally known as northern giant hornets, posed a significant threat to honeybees and other native insects in the Pacific Northwest. They can kill an entire hive in as little as 90 minutes by decapitating the bees. Officials described the search for hornets as something like a scene out of a movie. Teams captured one of the 2-inch hornets, attached a small tag to the insect, and tracked it back to the nest by listening to radio transmitter beeps. The hornet's sting also poses a threat to humans as it can penetrate a beekeeping suit, and a swarm of stings can be fatal. In 2013, more than 40 people were killed and over 1,000 injured in China by the insects. In North America, they were first spotted in British Columbia, Canada in August 2019 and confirmed in Whatcom County, Washington in December of that year. Despite these detections occurring around the same time and location, DNA evidence suggests the hornets found in Washington originated from South Korea, while the ones in British Columbia originated in Japan. Between 2020 and 2021, 4 nests were spotted inside tree hollows in Washington. This was distinctive as the hornets tend to nest in the ground. Spischiger theorized that nesting in trees could have been a trait of the specific hornets that turned up in Washington or a response to flooding at the time they were around. Eradication efforts, which began in 2019, involved collaboration between state, federal, and international government agencies, as well as support from community members. Over half of the confirmed detections came from the public, according to Spischiger. If the entire community hadn't stood up and taken action, there is a real good chance that we would just all be living with the northern giant hornet. The state continued trapping efforts through this year in Whatcom County. Despite trapping and continued public outreach, no additional hornets have been detected in the area. The last trap was removed from that part of the state on December 5th. There was a suspicious hornet sighting in Kitsap County, south of Port Orchard, in October, according to the State Department of Agriculture. But this report was based on an image provided by a member of the public, and the department was unable to get the hornet. The department will continue trapping in this area as a precaution until 2025, but so far, trapping and community outreach haven't yielded any evidence of northern giant hornets in the area, the agency said. Although they are now eradicated from the state, we will always be keeping an eye out for them and encourage community members to do the same, Spischiger said. They got here once and they could do it again. Right here in Corvallis, the Oregon State University Extension is training a new team to assess the status of Oregon's native wild bees. Author Kim Picorni reports, In every corner of Oregon, land managers worry about restrictions they may face if native bee species are listed under Federal Endangered Species Act. Knowing the status of Oregon's 780 bee species has become a hot topic. Oregon State University Extension Service is working to ensure federal agencies have an accurate picture of the status of the state's bees. Starting in 2024, volunteers trained by the extension roam the state searching out wild bees and plants that support them. The results will provide a snapshot of the current range of each species to better assess their status prior to federal evaluations. The new project, led by Andoni Melathopoulos, OSU Extension Pollinator Specialist, will train and then send volunteers into the field. They call themselves the Bee Team. The Bee Team is based on the TV show The A-Team, says Melathopoulos. They would solve any problem if you could find them because they had so many skills. The Bee Team is easy to find. It's a crack group of highly trained volunteers who can be deployed across the West to do a hardcore survey of bees. The team is designed to get the data. The project might be based on a TV show, but the actors are on a serious mission to document the native bees of Oregon and beyond. Their work will fill in the gaps in knowledge about where bees live and the plants they depend on for nutrition and to lay their eggs. Accurate data will be a key factor when it comes to the decision of whether or not the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lists a bee under the Endangered Species Act. That's where the Bee Team comes in. Those who complete the intense training will reach journey level as a master melittologist, a one-of-a-kind group of community scientists trained by Melathopoulos to collect and curate specimens for native bees for the Oregon Bee Project, a cooperative effort to document the state's bees. The Master Melittologist program has created one of the largest data sets on native bees and their preferred plants in the world and led to countless new discoveries in the Pacific Northwest. We're working toward a more data-driven land use policy that conserves the state's bees but assures working lands remain productive, Melathopoulos said. And we're making investments in the right place, putting money where we need it most. Tools like this will be really helpful for legislators, conservationists, policymakers, and others. The Endangered Species Act requires landowners and managers to work the land in ways that preserve endangered species. In order to comply, they need to know if a bee species actually warrants listing, and if so, how to best aid in its recovery. The key questions when considering whether to designate a bee species as endangered revolve around three questions. Where are the bees? How are they doing? What habitat are they in? Melathopoulos said. Without precise answers to these questions, species could be listed that are in fact neither threatened or endangered, and working lands could be subject to restrictions that might not help their species recover. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is charged with accepting species for the Endangered Species Act lists and must evaluate whether an animal is endangered or threatened. If it is, the habitat occupied by the species might be designated as critical, resulting in restrictions on the activities permitted on private and public land. Yet the data needed to accomplish this is in short supply for Oregon's bees. What little there is buried in entomology museum collections. Say a beekeeper wants to move colonies onto federal land for them to catch fireweed bloom, which makes wonderful honey. They may face restrictions because of competition with a threatened or endangered bee, or a farmer who wants to apply a certified pesticide can't do it because their activities are within an area designated as critical habitat. Everyone is impacted. It's important to ensure before any such restrictions are imposed, we have a clear science-based basis for doing so. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Agriculture is funding this project. The training will put the master melittologists on the bee team in critical parts of the West to do surveys where there are data gaps. In addition, the project involves building a tool that tells the federal and state agencies which bees are there and which plants they visit, and most importantly, where are the hot spots on their lands that are expected to have exceptionally high bee diversity. If land managers knew where the bees are, they can employ enough resources to keep bees healthy and off the threatened or endangered lists of the Endangered Species Act, Melithopoulos said. Many species of native bees, close to 800 is the latest estimate, live in Oregon, and some are very rare. Data would be helpful in a number of ways, and if there's a hot spot, land managers may need to exercise caution, turning their attention instead to areas where rare bees are not located. The Endangered Species Act is the law, Melithopoulos said. Listing species under the law has been a divisive issue, but we feel with more data and tools, we can create a win-win for bees and working lands. Oregon already has one bee listed, the Franklin bumblebee. We're expecting more. This work ensures that we are prepared. This was a news story on the OSU Extension's efforts to assess the status of Oregon's native wild bees, written by Kim Picorni. And now, an autumn update from Corvallis's Applied Institute of Ecology, written by Claire Rubens in September 2024. Since 2019, the Institute for Applied Ecology has studied the interactions of plants and their insect pollinators in Willamette Valley prairies, with a spectral focus on the Willamette daisy, Kincaid's lupin, and the golden paintbrush. Equipped with quadrets, insect nets, and plastic spoons, the 2024 pollinator crew set out to accomplish three main objectives this season. Resurvey forb communities to quantify floral resources for pollinators at five sites along the Willamette Valley. To continue plant and pollinator network surveys to better understand relationships between insect pollinators, our focal plant species, and the surrounding forb communities. And finally, to determine the most efficient and effective methods of hand pollinating Kincaid's lupin and golden paintbrush, and perform pollen supplementation trials in four populations to determine if pollen limitation may be a factor in their conservation status. New and exciting additions to our fieldwork this season were pollen supplementation trials of Kincaid's lupin and golden paintbrush. Previously, similar trials were conducted with Willamette daisy, but these methods needed to be adapted to suit the different flower structures. Perfecting this skill was one of the greatest challenges of the field season, but we learned from the best. Slowing down during the busy field season and making time to observe the ways in which bees manipulate flowers of our focal species was key to our success. Based on Christina Mitchell's preliminary work last season, we found that forceps were the most useful tool to assess the anthers of more robust golden paintbrush flowers. Black plastic spoons and our own hands were the tools of choice for the delicate and complex structures of lupin flowers. With the dark, smooth surface of the spoon, we were able to better keep track of the minute amounts of light-colored pollen that we collected from our donor plants. We then transported this precious pollen to the recipient plants. We pollinated each individual flower on lupin stalks, using one hand to expose the stigma and the other to delicately scrape pollen from the surface of the spoon to the head of the stigma. This work required extreme patience and dexterity and was only made more difficult by the intense heat that comes with prairie fieldwork. Later in the season, the seeds were collected from each hand-pollinated stalk and counted to determine if seed set increased with hand pollination. Using all that we learned this season, we plan to scale up these trials next year to include more individual plants at each site. With recent visits to the Oregon State Arthropod Collection and Oregon Bee Atlas Lab, we were able to make considerable progress on the species-level identification of bee specimens in the Institute of Applied Ecology's collection. Some notable highlights from this year included Melisodes clarkiae, or longhorn bees, which are specialist foragers, a common carpenter bee species, and a mysterious large all-black leafcutter bee. We plan to submit a number of samples for DNA analysis in the upcoming months, which will hopefully take us further in the identification process. Although a work in progress, our insect collection serves as a very important reference for current and future pollinator work conducted in the Willamette Valley. We greatly acknowledge the cooperation and funding provided by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Land Management. We thank Lincoln Best, August Jackson, and Chris Marshall for assistance with species determinations and access to OSU facilities. This has been a review of the 2024 Willamette Valley Pollinator Field Season, written by Claire Rubens of the Institute for Applied Ecology.
Listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. The following is an article from the Central Oregon Daily News, dated December 2, 2024. Headline: Oregon introduces new statewide recycling rules to combat plastic waste. And the article is written by Alex Baumhard. Starting next summer, Oregonians across the state will begin to receive a standardized list of what can and cannot be recycled statewide. And owners and managers of apartment complexes and multi-unit housing will need to prepare to provide recycling for residents. These are among new rules around recycling finalized recently by Oregon's Environmental Quality Commission following 4 years of negotiation and planning. The Plastic Pollution and Recycling Modernization Act will go into effect July 1, 2025, making it easier for Oregonians to recycle. It will establish new packaging fees for companies selling products in Oregon based on the weight and recyclability of the material. Hard-to-recycle materials, such as plastics, will command higher fees from companies than products that are easily recycled, ideally incentivizing producers to choose lighter, more sustainable materials. This follows regulations in Oregon in recent years that require manufacturers to pick up some of the end-of-life costs of paint, mattresses, and electronics, or to invest in programs to recycle such products. Senator Michael Dembrow, who championed the Plastic Pollution and Recycling Modernization Act in legislature in 2021, said, "Part of the goal is to move companies into more recyclable materials. There is a cost to packaging that needs to be internalized." The rules also give authority to collect and invest some new packaging fees to the Circular Action Alliance, or CCA, a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. Local governments and the alliance will be in charge of reinvesting fees in projects that will improve Oregon's recycling infrastructure. The alliance was formed in 2022 by 20 multinational corporations in the food, beverage, retail, and consumer goods industries, including Amazon, Coca-Cola, and Nestle. It oversees similar recycling programs that are rolling out as a result of new policies in California, Colorado, Maine, and Maryland. Under Oregon's new rules, environmental officials will release a standardized list of items that can be recycled across the state beginning summer of 2025. Owners and managers of multifamily buildings, such as duplexes and apartment buildings, will also need to eventually provide recycling services for residents. Two other bills passed in Oregon in 2023 will require manufacturers to label products to indicate whether and where they can be recycled in Oregon and ban the use of styrofoam containers for takeout food. The latter, Senate Bill 543, will go into effect in January 2025. Rules under Senate Bill 123, the smart labeling bill, must be finalized by 2027. No nation on Earth produces more plastic waste than the U.S., according to a 2022 report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. The average person in the U.S. in 1980 produced about 60 pounds of plastic waste per year. Today, each person in the U.S. produces more than 200 pounds of plastic waste each year, according to the EPA. Up to 2 million metric tons of that waste escapes into the environment each year, and much of it ends up in waterways and oceans, eventually becoming microplastics. The nonprofit Environment Oregon tested 30 rivers and lakes around the state in 2021 and found detectable levels of microplastics in all of them. Despite efforts to improve plastic recycling, no more than 9% of plastic waste generated in the U.S. each year gets recycled, according to the EPA. That was an article from the Central Oregon Daily News entitled, "Oregon Introduces New Statewide Recycling Rules to Combat Plastic Waste," dated December 2, 2024, and the author was Alex Baumhard. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
Listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics, a program heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., repeated Mondays from 5 to 6. You can find an archive of our programs at our website, korcfm.com. This is Dan Kroll. I am in the Southtown studio, and I am joined today by Bjorn Beer. And I happened to just stumble across a letter he wrote to the Gazette Times in the As I See It section about resigning from the City Planning Commission. And I had thought about just reading the letter myself. Then I thought, no, it'd be better to actually get Bjorn in the studio. So I was lucky enough today for KORC News, Music, and Civics to get Bjorn to join us. Thank you for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
And I see that you have printed up your letter that you wrote to the Gazette Times. When was that published?
A couple days ago, I think on Thursday.
Thursday the 26th? So if you look up the Gazette Times from Thursday, December 26th of 2024, you can see this letter that he is going to read to us now.
Great. Why I resigned as a planning commissioner. Recently, I told the Corvallis Planning Commission that I resigned my seat because I needed to focus on an innovative, affordable housing preservation model that I worked on up in Portland that I'd like to scale across the state. While this is certainly true, it's not the full truth. I resigned out of frustration. Many of the changes needed to give Corvallis more abundant and diverse housing options, as well as a more robust tax base, are battled at every step of the way by a short-sighted philosophy that seems to permeate the current powers that be in Corvallis. Yes, things are changing, but not fast enough. Granted, the Planning Commission can't change things. It just adjudicates on the rules already on the books. For example, the Planning Commission couldn't help that the city recently arbitrarily charged a $50,000 SDC fee on a startup medical practice next door to other medical practices that didn't have to pay these same SDC charges. The argument there was that these recovering cancer patients would increase road traffic. But now this road traffic and revenue and tax base for the city will travel to other cities. It isn't the Planning Commission's fault, for example, that my pilot project to preserve affordable housing had to be abandoned in town when the city insisted that a change of use from apartments to affordable condos would require an innovative developer pay for street improvements that provide questionable benefits to residents, citizens, and taxpayers. We had even lined up down payment assistance from private sources for the tenants to become owners of their affordable condos. Yet a buyer who retains the same property as apartments and then doubles rents over the next few years, they are not required to make those costly changes. How is it possible that the 2021 Senate Bill 458, which allows lot divisions for middle housing, was preempted by mostly aesthetic street improvements of questionable value? Why did the, quote, progressive, unquote, city single out the one buyer who had a vision for affordable housing? There is no why. This loss of naturally occurring affordable housing was preventable, but I was powerless within the Planning Commission. Many great people in the city staff tried to help, but there are still some in the elected leadership of the city who talk progressive but walk regressive by making Corvallis notoriously anti-development, which means working-class folks cannot afford to live here. This is an elitist, privileged, and regressive worldview. So I resigned as planning commissioner because it was easier for me to do my affordable housing pilot project in Portland, of all places, than in my own hometown of Corvallis. There is a lack of leadership at the local level. But I also resigned from city politics because change will have to come from the top down. For example, the Middle Housing Initiative at the state level forced municipalities across the entire state to abandon low-density residential zoning policies that were inefficient, unfair, and not sustainable. What if our local leaders had a real conversation around housing abundance and affordability rather than doing the very bare minimum to comply with state law? Sadly, I've had to take my pioneering housing idea elsewhere, and I've had dozens of clients in town who have abandoned innovative and progressive projects in Corvallis. Everyone I know professionally has clients who have sadly had to take their ideas and tax dollars elsewhere, which ironically makes the progressive goals the city leadership claims to advocate much harder to achieve. If you want progressive ideas, we must broaden the tax base and ensure diverse, abundant, and affordable housing options. And to do that, business as usual must change.
That was Bjorn Beer reading from his As I See It letter, which was published in the Gazette Times Thursday, the 26th of December, 2024, if you would like to read that. He joins us today. That was him who read his own letter here in the Southtown studio on KORC News, Music, and Civics. Can you tell us more about your project that you were wanting to spearhead here in town?
Yeah. It's an affordable condoization model where private capital comes in, buys an apartment, converts the units to condos, condoizes them. There's a lot line adjustment to make that happen. And then the current residents have a first right of purchase to buy those units as condos. And this group, it's a private sector group, even helps with down payment assistance for the current renters to become owners. And frequently in this model, they are buying at around the same monthly cost as it had cost to rent. And that's including things like property taxes, insurance, etc., and HOA dues.
And we definitely know that Corvallis is the most rent-burdened city in this entire state.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had to keep my article short enough to be in the paper, but we're actually, I think, the top severe rent-burdened city in the state. I think I have the stats in front of me here. 40% have severe burden. That means they pay for 50% or more of their monthly income on rent. So we are leading the state in that dubious distinction. And another interesting factoid that I want to bring to bear is for campus housing, which is a little bit different than workforce housing, but it's still in the same market. It has the same effect. We are actually eighth in the nation in terms of an imbalance between supply and demand. So there's just not enough new supply coming in the market. So this problem has been decades in the making, but it's become obviously a very critical problem.
So when the Corvallis city leadership gets the reputation for being anti-development, what kind of projects do they stop? Would these be ones within the city boundary, or would it maybe allow us to expand further south, you know, beyond, like on Highway 99?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to be clear that the city staff is amazing, and there are a lot of projects in the pipeline now in Southtown, a lot of affordable housing groups. There's a lot of exciting changes happening in Corvallis. I don't want to minimize that at all. I'm more speaking to the just general business climate, whether it's downtown, whether it's north side of town, south side of town. Just to do things in Corvallis, everything is harder. Everything is more costly, from the SDC charges to the approval process on projects. I could go into a number of examples.
Tell us really quick, what does SDC stand for?
System development charges. And that was the case I alluded to that was sort of the tipping point for me. In the article, I had a plastic surgeon client who was trying to open up a practice. And my wife knows some of his patients, and there are people that were literally in mid-care needing, you know, reconstructive surgery after breast cancer, for example. And these folks, you know, need a place to see their provider because the hospital terminated that group. And long story short is we finally found him a great place to start up his practice. And the city at the last minute said it's going to be $50,000 charge because of increased traffic.
So that would be the SDC of $50,000?
Yeah, system development charges. And that's typically for like a new development if you're, you know, having to, you know, connect services and infrastructure. So you build a new development and there's fees associated with, you know, connecting.
Yeah, getting hooked up with the infrastructure that the city offers.
Exactly. And a lot of people forget, too, that a lot of these private developers are paying for those improvements as well. So they're paying for the lines to be put down.
I was going to ask, is it the developers who have to pay for these?
Yeah, and it can vary in different municipalities about how those costs are apportioned and split. But yeah, and so what happened is this client of mine had a very large medical build out, but it's light medical. There's no heavy procedures or anesthesia or anything. It's just basically going from one office code to the next. So it's currently zoned office and it'll be zoned office in the future. But the architect at the last minute told my client, oh, and by the way, the city's going to charge an additional $50,000. And the city staff, they were helpful in explaining the problem, but I think they were powerless to change what's on the books. But it just, that episode speaks to a wider problem in town of, you know, if you go into a room of developers or real estate brokers and you were to say, where would you want to open up shop? Everyone's going to say anywhere but Corvallis. They're going to say go to Albany. They're going to say go to Lebanon. They're going to say go to even Sweet Home because Corvallis is so hard to deal with.
I've definitely heard that in the past. And from a housing perspective, I know rent in this town is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Rent is, you know, as we discussed, we have the most severe rent burden municipality in all of all of Oregon. And it is a fixable problem. And I think, as I mentioned in my article, I think that the middle housing initiative that came from the state level down was a good step in the right direction, but it's my perception and the perception of many people who are even in the affordable housing arena, and they won't say this publicly because they, you know, have a lot of business in front of the city, but the city is hard to deal with. And I think in terms of getting more density in current single family neighborhoods, it's still hard. It's just hard to do everything from innovative ideas like, you know, ADUs to cottage clusters. I think things are improving with ADUs in terms of the cost to do those. I think the SDC charges, I believe, are lowered or waived. But just things like that just should be very easy to address are much too hard in Corvallis.
Right. And it would seem that if the city wants to promote affordable housing or for maybe lower income people to be able to live here, there's a way for them to make that happen, whether it's through making it easier on developers. What are some other ideas?
Yeah, I think it's honestly, it's all hands on deck. The affordable housing crisis in Oregon is particularly bad. It's bad everywhere in the country, but I think it's going to take a number of things. It's going to take new units being built of all product type. That means everything from just single family homes, but especially plexes, especially apartments. Urban infill currently in neighborhoods. If there's a property that needs to be, you know, raised to the ground, there are a lot of older properties like that in town. having a pathway to build higher density in Corvallis is key, and then we can maintain and preserve our green spaces, which is something we, you know, it's one of the reasons why we all like living here. I think it's going to take preservation is a key thing that's being it's being left out of the conversation, not just locally but also nationally and at the state level. How do we preserve current affordable housing assets? And every housing authority across the country has housing assets that they have to sell because they're operationally inefficient, insurance is too expensive, there might be deferred maintenance. So how do we incentivize private capital to come in and say, yeah, we're going to pay for this roof, we're going to pay for these improvements, and keep the units at, whether it's 100% AMI or 80% AMI, that's a level of affordability. So I think public-private partnerships are going to be essential in the years ahead. And I think making a more pro-development environment is part of that, because Corvallis is just too hard to do work in. People would rather go to Albany, for example.
We're speaking with Bjorn Beer. He is a resident of Corvallis, also the vice president of SVN, which stands for Sperry Van Ness International. They're a commercial brokerage, and he specializes in affordable housing across the state. I connected with him because I saw his letter in the last Thursday's edition of the Gazette Times about why he resigned from the City Planning Commission. I am not a renter. I actually own my house with, you know, a little bit of a balance left on it, and I pay $1,200 a month for my mortgage, and I honestly feel like compared to other rent in Corvallis, I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, I think we're definitely in the most rent-burdened market in Oregon, as we've discussed, and I think there's a lot of focus at the local and state level about legislative changes by fiat that basically say, you know, whether it's rent control or whether it's this, that, or, you know, such regulation. And I think all those are band-aids on the deeper wound, which is we're just not building enough units. That's the fundamental problem, is we don't have enough supply. And that is especially critical in Corvallis. So what we need is density, and we need more urban infill. And I think that just is going to take a change in political leadership and in prioritization. I think we just fundamentally, when a politician talks about you know, what they're going to do for the affordable housing crisis, I think the ultimate question that every citizen, every journalist needs to ask them is, how many units does that translate to? How many new units? How many units preserved that aren't going to go to market rate forces? So I think it's a multifaceted problem that needs multifaceted solutions, but we just have to resist the anytime a politician says, oh yeah, we just need to pass this one law. I mean, no, what does that do for new supply? That's fundamentally the most important thing, is new supply.
And if there's anything we've learned growing up in America, it could also be when a politician speaks, question the source.
Right, exactly.
I should ask, what would be that magic number, say for a two-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment, what would be that number for affordable housing? I just remember when I moved to Corvallis, I rented from Dirksen up at Conifer in 99 in a modest apartment, and it was $495 a month. Yeah. And this was in 2005. Mm. We've climbed quite a bit since there. Is there a magic number in your head for, you know, just your standard one-person, two-person dwelling rental?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And what I do in commercial brokerage, we do a lot of, you know, rent surveys, and we'll do, you know, comparable apples-to-apples comparisons of properties. And, you know, the details and finishes are kind of important, and the location is important. But ultimately, there are tables for each county nationally, actually, and in the state of Oregon, of course, where you have what's called area median income. So if, you know, it's 80% AMI property or a 50% AMI, that would be considered, you know, deeply affordable.
AMI stands for?
Area median income. And so, you know, 100% AMI versus 80% AMI, there's different subsidies that are tied back to those levels of affordability. And it gets really complicated in Byzantine, in affordable housing lingo. But ultimately, you know, what I see as a commercial broker specializing in apartments across the state is the lower rent markets are the ones where they've built more. And that's just, it's a clear correlation. And we see that nationally too. In areas where they've overbuilt apartments is where they actually had some rent decline in a few submarkets. And that's because they overbuilt. So I think we just have to have more supply of all product types, not just the deep affordable and not just luxury homes. We need the missing middle is what it's called.
Do you think that like maybe a number between like 500 and 800 a month? I mean, is that even realistic at this point with all of the supply plus the demand?
I think that really depends on the type of property, the location, and the way that subsidy works. And that could be there's federal funds, there's state funds, and there's local funds. So it gets very complicated about how those are, you know, are they housing choice vouchers, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of nuance and detail that go into that. So it's hard to answer just that in a blanket fashion. You know, ultimately, what's going to keep rents affordable is, again, it's just there's no law in Salem or locally that can be passed that will completely waive away the you know, laws of supply and demand. Like we do exist in a marketplace, and we have to have enough supply that will force rents to stabilize. Otherwise, they're just going to keep going up. Even if you put more and more onerous rent caps, that just in my experience, just knowing the private sector well, that just forces a lot of real estate investors to you know, evict for remodeling costs. They'll say, we need to get you out to remodel the unit faster. So they'll just do their business plan faster. So it doesn't really stop evictions.
So like if they have a rent cap put on them, they might then just say, well, in that case, we do need to evict everyone because we need to make all these wholesale changes.
Yeah. And I think the rent caps, that's a whole nother subject and a politically contentious one. All I'll say is this, is that it's really just a Band-Aid, and municipalities can say they've done something without actually doing the thing that needs to be done, which is to build more supply. That costs money, and that takes approval, that takes changes in zoning, that takes standing up to a lot of not in my backyard NIMBY interests that are going to crop up even amongst well-intentioned people. So I think it's a Band-Aid that allows people to say we've fixed the patient when they actually haven't. I think ultimately we need more supply. There's no way around that.
We are joined by Bjorn Beer. If you are a reader of the Corvallis Gazette Times, he did write a letter in the As I See It section of Thursday from this past week, which was the 26th of December. He is a resident of Corvallis and the vice president of Sperry Van Ness International, and he joined us in the Southtown studio today. Perhaps you could come back at some point, and we could talk more about this topic, as it is multifaceted.
Yeah, I'd love to come back and talk about anything relating to real estate and especially affordable housing. It's near and dear to my heart, so happy to be here, and yeah, thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you again for your time, Bjorn Beer. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll.
When your car is making a strange noise, no matter what it is, you can't just pretend it's not happening.
That's an interesting sound.
It's like your mental health. If you're struggling and feeling overwhelmed, it's important to do something about it. It can be as simple as talking to someone in your community or just taking a deep, calming breath when you need it. Nice. For mental health resources, check out loveyourmindtoday.org. At loveyourmindtoday.org, you'll find information that may help you get through a tough time. Things like tips for dealing with stress, how to navigate difficulties like financial worries, anger, substance use, and more. You can also find real stories of how people navigated their own mental health challenges. Because once you start to address the problem, you can go so much further. Visit loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
I smoked cigarettes for 24 years, one pack a day. That is called 12-pack years. If I smoked 2 packs a day, it would be 48 pack years, or 1/2 pack a day would be 12 pack years. Pack years measure the years of exposure to smoking tobacco and the 7,000 chemicals created by a burning cigarette. I thought I was smoking tobacco and never thought about inhaling pesticides, additives, and chemicals, including those from burning cigarette paper. But my quitting had nothing to do with chemicals, health issues, anti-smoking advertising, or social pressures. I did not quit for family or to add years to my life, nor did I quit to prevent the holes in my beautiful silk ties. Quitting was not an instant decision. It took me years to become willing to quit. I became willing because I started getting short of breath. I felt like I was suffocating, drowning. That scared me. It amazed me how quickly I got my breath back after quitting. And after only 1 year, I felt like I had never smoked. For information on how to quit, call 800-QUIT-NOW or go to smokefreeoregon.com. My name is Donald Russell. I have lived in Corvallis, Oregon for over 25 years.